You're listening to the Young Opportunist Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast, guys. In part three of the Founder Series, we are bringing you a heavy hitter in the space, AJ Prakash.
AJ is a serial entrepreneur starting over eight companies across sectors, including tech, crypto, international trade, and most recently, education. He really is a wealth of knowledge with an interesting and inspiring journey. To add to this, he's been listed on the Forbes 30 Under 30, mentioned in well-known publications, including the World Economic Forum, New York Times, and CoinDesk.
His most recent company, Entry Level, has an incredible mission, helping the next 1 billion internet users from underdeveloped countries get the jobs of tomorrow through upskilling and reskilling via interactive programs and courses. An incredible mission.
In this episode, we cover AJ's incredible entrepreneurial journey and how he's been able to start eight companies across multiple different sectors, how AJ has remained enthusiastic despite some of his companies failing early on, including the importance of dusting yourself off, learning from your mistakes, and just moving on.
Practical frameworks you can utilize to know whether a business idea is viable and worth pursuing in the first couple days, the three-step framework to grow an organic audience rapidly, and why people should focus on solving painful problems.
Let's get underway with today's episode. Welcome back to the podcast, guys. As we said in the introduction, we are very excited to bring you part three of the Founder Series. Today, we have the very honor and privilege to be joined by one of the biggest serial entrepreneurs and a Forbes 30 Under 30, AJ Prakash. AJ, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me.
I guess before we get underway, diving into all the little nitty gritty, we'd love if you could give our audience a brief insight into your journey and I guess how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So brief insight. It's always difficult to give a brief insight, like, because I feel like I've been doing this for 8 years now. So not a terribly long time. I'm still under 30. So like, you know, I'm still got a long way to go in terms of like what I want to do career-wise. But I guess I started off with a mechanical engineering and physics background, and I don't use any of that today, unfortunately. Sometimes I use my physics degree to flex on people, but that's about it. And I guess like, long story short, tried and started like a couple of different businesses throughout university, and then after university, tried even more businesses across like just random stuff, like a beer industry for a bit. Did like a quantum computing company, which didn't go anywhere, did some blockchain stuff, did some stuff in international trade. And then like what I ended up finding was like throughout the entire procedure, like what I ended up like doing all the time without pay and all that kind of stuff, what ended up being education. And so, yeah, year before, COVID like messed up my entire time frame, but like right after COVID started, gave me some time to think about what I wanted to do. And it ended up being an education company, ed tech, like was really hot at the time because everyone wanted to invest in like, you know, remote working stuff and like ed tech. And so I was like, it's now or never. So I started an education company called Entry Level. So yeah, fast forward a year and a half or so, been building that company out, trying to figure out different things, and we've been experimenting. And what we figured out is like how to do cohort-based education for underserved markets like, you know, Africa and Asia. And so like one of the things is like over here, I think what we take for granted is like the boot camps and all the educational programs we have. And yes, they cost thousands of dollars sometimes, but like we could feasibly pay for it if we wanted to, right? Whereas someone in Nigeria, like who may earn $1,000 in a year, like can't afford to pay for a program like that. So we're trying to make super cheap programs with the same caliber and same sort of feel that you would have at boot camp. And so, yeah, that's what I've been working on for the last year and a half.
As I said before we dive into Entry Level, which we can't wait, we're really excited about. Can we flash back to, I guess, that decision during uni and potentially after you graduated? There's a lot of pressure to dive in and start applying for grad programs and things in the field that you've studied. How did you have the, I guess, ambition and I guess like audacity to go and try all these different companies, especially across so many different fields? Was there a lot of pressure from your peers and things like that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like, I feel like you need an instigating factor to do some of this stuff, right? Like for university, like when I went into university, my game plan was to become a physics professor. It was like a pretty like straightforward game plan. Like I was going to become a mechanical engineer and then after a couple of years, retire and become a physics professor. Like that was my game plan. It was very straightforward. But then, I met other entrepreneurs, like much older than myself, who came and did workshops and programs at the university. I was like, this is really cool. Like if I want to make impact, it sounds like being a scientist like is not the way to make an impact like in a meaningful way. It's like actually being an entrepreneur, right? Mm-hmm. And so I started looking into that as like more of a way to get my ideas out there. And what I also realized is that I'm not smart enough to be the best scientist in the world, unfortunately, right? And what sucks about that is, like, if you're not the smartest scientist in the world, you're not going to work on the coolest problems. You're going to work on, like, repeating other people's experiments. And I was like, fuck that. I don't want to do that. And so I made a very quick leap into, like, trying my own thing and just sort of diving into entrepreneurship. And so started a nonprofit called Real Skills in, like, I think a second year university. In terms of family and, like, friend sentiment, like, I think back then, like, entrepreneurship was not as cool as it was now. I don't know if it's cool now, but it feels a lot cooler than it was back then. And there was definitely my investment banking friends who were, like, looking down on me. And, like, looking back now, they probably weren't friends of mine. They were just bullies. But, like, you know, it was a very interesting time to start a company, because, like, not only, like, does the market punch you in the face when you release shitty products, but also you get your friends who just, like, berate you. It's like, oh, AJ, you're on startup number three, aren't you? Like, oh, gonna fail again. And, like, you just have a lot of negativity around you. And it doesn't help when your parents are also just, like, don't get it. Like, not that they don't want to support you, but they just don't understand what you're doing. So, like, I would share a win with my mom and she would be like, okay, cool, when are you getting a job? And I'd be like, well, you know, that's not really the point of my story here, mom, but, you know, thanks for listening. So yeah, it was a very interesting time. And I think it was very difficult and it was definitely low points. But, you know, you have to, one, those, like, other friends that I had were going through the same thing. Like, some of the entrepreneur buddies that I had, like, who are doing it still now, like, had the same experience as me in university. So we bonded over that. And then I had other friends who were a lot more supportive and willing to help out here and there. Like, all of my early employees and, like, volunteers for the businesses I had were just all my friends, right? Like, you know, I'd bug them to do something for me. So there are definitely those people that helped me get through those times as well.
It's crazy how when you grow up, like, people around you aren't as supportive as when you were younger. Mm-hmm. I heard something the other day talking about how when little kids try and get on their feet and start walking and everyone's around there, like, supporting them, being like, come on, you can get up, and, like, have a little bit of laugh when he falls over, but then keep on supporting. But when you grow older, it's like there's not as much support and people look down on that. It's like, oh, you know, get a 9-to-5 kind of thing. Like, what are you doing? You, as you said, your mates, like, saying, you know, you're on your third business. It's just crazy how things turn when we get older.
Mm.
I think people just aren't as okay with failing when you're older. Like, for some reason, as kids, like, we don't care about failing. We don't have that fear of failure. But then as we grow, it almost becomes a part of us. Like, we just can't fail anymore. So I think that's the biggest sort of detrimental thing. Like, you know, you think about your traditional pathway, like, in high school, you have to pick the right degree. And then in university, you have to pick the right subjects and you have to pick the right job. And then you just work that job till you die, basically, right? It was the old sort of mantra with, like, what you follow. And then you think about that and it's like, okay, well, how does a 17-year-old actually pick what they're going to do for the rest of their life with no life experience and understanding what might be good? So, yeah, for some reason, you're not allowed to fail. And because of that, and sunk cost fallacy, you have people who, like, studied medicine for 10, 15 years and then, like, are a doctor simply because, like, that's what they chose and, like, they have no choice now. And I know people like that who are, like, are a doctor because it's, like, too late for them. They can't do anything else, which I don't think is true, but I don't think me sitting there trying to convince them for 2 hours is going to help. So
if we look back, maybe even before university, have you always been entrepreneurial? Like, you know, the classic lemonade on the driveway stories you hear, maybe to that, not that extreme, but were there any, I guess, similarities, or were your parents entrepreneurial? How was that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I feel like every entrepreneur needs that. Like, oh, I grew up this way. Like, this is how I was when I was a kid. Like, I was 2 years old and I was, like, you know, selling socks down the street. And, like, I'm not the biggest fan of those stories. But at the same time, like, there were definitely things I did in high school that, like, I can draw back to thinking, okay, cool. Like, this was like sort of the start of, like, what I wanted to do. So I did this thing called the F1 in schools competition back in high school, which I thought was really cool, because you build this, like, little CO2 powered car. You have to design the car. You have to raise sponsorship money. And you race it against other schools, and then you go to national championships and international championships. And that is really interesting, because you have to raise, like, $5,000-$10,000 to build this damn car, right? Your wheels, the wheels that you manufacture, like, a CNC machine, cost like $1,000 by themselves, right? And so, like, that was a really interesting thing, because I thought that's what it meant to be an engineer, right? So when I did that project, I was like, this is awesome. I want to be an engineer. But actually, as I grew older, I realized that was just an entrepreneurship skill set, because you have a team of five. I was the team manager. You have to hire a design engineer. You have to hire, like, a finance manager and like a bunch of other people, right? And you build this team, right? So that was fascinating. So I think that was like one of the earliest stages of like what I thought was engineering, which ended up actually being entrepreneurship. And the other thing I did like back in 2009 was I used to like build computers for people and just sort of like sell it as well. But like, I didn't really have any understanding of like profit margin or anything like that. Like I just got $50 to build someone a computer and then like another $50 to build something on a computer. And like, I mainly did it because it was fun to build computers, right? And I could like trial and error on other people's parts as opposed to my own parts and then like save up to buy my own parts from my own computer. So I think those are sort of the two stories that I have, like sort of trying this stuff in high school.
Mm. You really are like the definition of a serial entrepreneur. You've basically started approximately 8 companies, and correct me if I'm wrong, but talk us through some of these types of companies you've started and what has driven you to pivot so many times and build so many different types of companies.
Yeah. So like, I don't even know if 8 companies is an accolade anymore because like most of them are failures, right? But like the reason why I say 8 companies is because I'd like to wear my failures like a badge, like a honor, like just saying like I've gone and tried this and it didn't really work. And I think it's mainly the failures. Sounds so stereotypical, but it's like the failures that like helped cultivate where I am today. And so like, I guess the mindset here is that I treat it very scientifically and very experimental, right? Like you have all these founders who work on these companies for like 3-4 years on the same product, right? Like I've now met so many founders who are like, oh, I've been building this thing for the last year and they haven't talked to any customers, right? And they don't even know if people want it. They don't know anything about the market. Whereas now, like the way I think about it is like, you know, you want to launch as quickly as possible. You want to get it to the market as quickly as possible. And then you want to get punched in the face by the market or succeed, right? Like I want to fail as soon as possible. And so I think like the first couple of iterations for that process, like took a while, right? So like, you know, one of the first companies that started, like, I think it took like 2 years to even get a product out. And then like, you know, we're talking to customers and we're just fumbling. And I was like, now I think about that, the entire 2-year learning process for that business, I can do probably in a week now. And that's sort of how I think about it, right? I try to concentrate as much learning as possible. Like I try to figure out what it is about the market that's so interesting. Like what kind of economic model will make sense? Like what kind of product makes sense? Like how can I tweak the product to make, to sell people on that product? All that kind of stuff. So I think that's sort of the mindset, like a very experimental mindset. Like, you know, I'll throw 6 darts and just see which one lands. Right. So even though there's 8 companies, like there's probably like 80 ideas I've launched, right? Like there are so many Shopify stores have started that like just went nowhere. You know, so many lessons around that. So I think that's the main thing. So even though like there's been 8 proper companies that have started and like most of them have failed, like I think it's been important to understand different things and learn it. So I really think that over the last 8 years, like the most important part has been the skill set. Like I think I've just built such a robust skill set when it comes to launching stuff that like the 0-1 phase, I love the 0-1 phase because I've just become so optimized for it. The 1-10 phase, I'm realizing I don't really like that much. Like that's sort of where my current company is. And like now it's a lot of like, you know, one-on-one meetings and like strategy sessions and management. And like, I got to figure out how to do quarterly reviews for my team and stuff like that. I don't like that at all. That's not as interesting to me. I like the 0-1 phase, very scrappy. You're trying to test things as quickly as possible. So yeah, I don't know if that necessarily answered your question, but like, that's sort of like, I guess what's conducive about me to like, you know, starting those so many different companies.
Yeah, that's good. And it comes back to Michael Batko said the same thing about trying to collect as many like data points as possible. And it comes back to that saying of trying to throw things at the wall and seeing which one sticks.
Yeah.
And that's the best way you can know when you're on a good idea or.
Yeah. And something we talked about a lot on the podcast over the past couple of months is like perfectionism and how so many people are almost too scared to get that punch in the face, but that's the thing that they need to get the feedback. Or as you talked about, the founders that spend a year on one product trying to get it absolutely perfect, but then who knows, there could be a competitor who's already consulted with heaps of different customers, because that's a whole other aspect as well, is like the competition out there. Is that something that you think about when you're doing your 0-1?
Yeah, for sure. I think like I try to launch as quickly as possible, like in terms of like, you know, getting that punch in the face from the market. Like I think that's important. I think The difficult part is getting that first punch. I think like it's very difficult to put yourself out there and like, you know, get feedback and like, you know, get judgment from your friends and family and other people you don't know as well. But I think once you just launch a couple of things, you start not caring about it as much, right? Yeah. Like now it's the point where like, you know, if I launch 10 things versus 100 things, I'm still going to get the same amount of shit from people. So like, does it even matter at this point? Like, you know, 100 versus 101 things. And so, yeah, with the 0 to 1 phase, like, you know, it's really about, like, you can do research, like looking at your competitors and things like that, but it's getting as much learnings and data points as possible from firsthand investigation as opposed to second, right? Like you can sit there looking at as much research papers as you want, but there's nothing better than just trying it yourself. And yes, you may lose some money, you may lose some time, but if you're willing to put in those reps, then like, you know, you'll get that ROI eventually.
Yeah, for sure. As you've kind of just said, and we read through a lot of your blog posts, which we like absolutely love. There's just so much value there, and we'll definitely link them all in the show notes below. But you said that what you just talked about is you've thought over hundreds of ideas and tested over 80, and from that 80, you've ended up forming around like 8 companies that have passed that 0 to 1 test. For those people that have a bunch of ideas in the daily, from your experience, how can these people filter through these ideas and know which one is the best to pursue? And maybe this is just more from a general point of view, because I know you have quite a sound like system that you go through. But for those people that, like even me and Reese, like I feel like we have a million ideas on the daily, always bouncing off each other. But it's knowing which one's worth putting the time into and even the capital into as well.
Yeah. So one of the frameworks I find really useful for like sorting through my ideas is the ICE framework. So it's like using growth marketing quite a bit, but I use it for ideas. So the ICE framework is just 3 different things. So it's impact, confidence, and ease, right? And you score them out of 10 and then you multiply all 3 together. So for example, like, you know, you come with an idea for a concept and you think, okay, like what kind of impact will this have? And like, for me, it's impact in terms of like, how is this going to impact my life in terms of a fun quota? Like, am I going to have a lot of fun doing this? And an impact is like, also like financially, is this like a $10,000 idea? Is this a $100,000 idea? Like, you know, what's that impact like? And I sort of balance those 2 factors together, right? Because I also think the fun component is like pretty important as opposed to just the financial aspect. Then it's confidence. Like if I launch this, how confident am I? Like, what's my gut feel that this is going to succeed? And I think you build that over reps as well. So you may be wrong the first couple of times and you most definitely be wrong most of the time, but like you just put a confidence factor there just for your gut feel. And you put ease of implementation. So that's E. Like how quickly could I get this out there? Like how easy is this product? There are some products, honestly, like I've just made like sales decks and I've just emailed a bunch of people and then they bank transfer me money. Like that's the easiest product, right? Because that's like taking 1 hour. So I think about how much time it's going to take me. Like max is like, I don't want to spend more than a week on it. So like it's 1 hour to a week is sort of the range. Then I multiply all the scores and then I just sort of go through them and like see which one I want to focus on, right? And I date that idea for a bit. And so like from there, once you pick 1 or 2 ideas you want to launch, like you then launch it in 1 hour, right? You give yourself 1 hour to do that entire thing. This like time minimization framework, I think is really interesting. Like if you think about like, all right, what do I want to achieve with this idea in a year? And then say like, okay, how can I move the needle in a month? Then you say, how can I move the needle in a day? And then how can I move the needle in an hour, right? Mm. Then you just do the most important thing to prove yourself wrong as quickly as possible. Like I want to fail instantly. Like, and what I'm trying to do is not prove that it's correct. I'm trying to prove that's wrong, right? Because like with hypothesis and theories, right? Like you can't really prove something is true because that's difficult sometimes. But what you try to do is you prove that it's not true, right? And so like that's what I sort of aim to go do as quickly as possible. So like step one, ICE framework, sort of go through my ideas. Step 2, how do I make a significant dent on this idea to prove myself wrong in the next hour, right? And that's basically it. That's how I started. And then if it's like something interesting that I think can keep going, then we'll keep going. But like there's so many things I've done like only for like a month, right? And I'll make some money for that month and then I'll just sort of like peace out for a bit. Like I've done that so like during lockdown, especially like if I got bored, I'll do something. And I think it's got to the point where like, you know, for example, I could do something that makes $2,000-$3,000 a month, which is cool, right? But for me, like if I get bored with the idea and I don't want to do it anymore, I just go do something else and I'll try a different idea for that month. Generally with like when I date these ideas, like I don't really get to the 5 or 6 figure mark with these sort of like per month in terms of like revenue. Like I'll just date it. I'll get a couple of $1,000 or maybe like, you know, at best, maybe like 50, 60 grand. I think the best experiment that I did for like 2 months was like 100 grand. And then I sort of pieced out after that. Right. But obviously I had to pay to actually build out the product. So I think profit margin on that was probably like 30, 40,000. But yeah, like that's sort of how I think about these like ideas. And the reason why I date ideas is because like, one, I have a main business I'm focused on. And I'm trying to make a really big business out of entry level, which is why I'm raising capital. So like I can't commit to anything else. So I just do it for fun on the weekends. But two, like I think it allows you to get around the block quite a bit. And I think about this, like, I hate to equate this to like actual dating, but like realistically, if you're trying to find like a girl or a guy like that you want to date, you need to get data points, right? Like you need to figure out like who's right for you. Like, you know, you want to date a couple of ideas and see what's right for you, right?
Yeah.
If you commit to a business, like honestly, I've started businesses. Like I did a business in the international trade space and I hated it, right? I did that for 2.5 years and it sucked. Like I hate the industry. I didn't like the people in it. I don't know if I should say that, but like just, it wasn't my kind of people, right? Like yeah. It wasn't a very techie space. And so I ended up quitting, ended up returning all my shares. And like, you know, I said, I didn't really want to be a part of it. But I think that was a big realization for me that like, you know, I need to have fun in what I work on as well. So I think too many people are too focused on like one attribute about business building, like the money aspect of things. But like, if you don't enjoy it as well, mm-hmm. you're going to wake up one day realizing you're putting all this work into something you hate. So yeah, that was a bit of a tangent. But the main points here is that like, you know, get your ideas, rank them, launch as quickly as possible and try to prove yourself wrong and date as many ideas as possible, to be honest.
Yeah. I love that you gave a practical like framework, the ICE way about it that people can actually follow. And that's funny about like the dating thing as well, because it is true. And the same with like trying to find what you want to do.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we've come to the realization that we need to try as many things as possible and actually know that we're passionate about it or not.
It also like kind of drops the ego out as well. Like unlike marrying idea, if we're going to keep on this analogy, if you're marrying idea, like if it turns out that it's not actually a good business, your ego is too built up that you can't just throw it away or realize that it maybe wasn't a right decision as well. So I think that's powerful.
Yeah. I don't know if it's correct to say, but it's like probably not falling in love with your product as well.
Yes.
Because if like you're falling in love with your product, then you can't really pivot. And that's probably something that is a really good attribute that you have, is you don't do that. And it allows you to have so much experience in so many different sectors and doing different things.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's two things here, right? Like one is that like a lot of people, when they first start their business, they associate their name with the business, right? Like they become the entry-level guy, right? Or like they become the Google guy. Like they're associated with that brand and it becomes hard to dissociate sometimes. And I think that's a big issue, right? You need to make sure as an entrepreneur, like depends what kind of entrepreneur, like if your life's work is to do X, then yes, there are people that associate their name brand with that. And that's what they do their entire lives, right? But a lot of entrepreneurs do a lot of different things, right? And so it's important to dissociate. The second thing is like, because of that, like in lieu of that, like you need to have a healthy amount of dissociation and a healthy amount of confidence at the same time. You know, like balancing these two different concepts at the same time. Like you have to dissociate yourself from the business, but at the same time, be super confident and passionate about what you're working on, which is like very difficult for some people, right? It's very difficult to balance those two things, right? Like with entry level, like when I pitch, like I pitch hard and like I believe and I have like the confidence that we're going to do this. But at the same time, I'm dissociated enough that like I know if like things aren't working and I need to change things up, or if I need to scrap the entire product and start again from scratch to solve the problem, for example. And so like I'm dissociated enough that I'm blinded by my own business, which is a big thing that happens, right? And when I'm not dissociated enough, I'll get someone else in the third party to give me an opinion. Like even today, like I got roasted by another founder on like a particular part of my business. And I was like, oh man, like I know this stuff, but hearing it from you, like I think I needed to hear that today. And so like I fixed that part of the business, right? So that was like, it's interesting when those things happen.
So I want to bring up another discussion point you brought up in another cool blog post about painful problems. And you say that in order for people to think about ideas, if you can't literally feel the problem, it's going to be really hard to execute it. And you trying to explain to a user to come on board and they have this problem and explaining the problem, it's going to be really hard to to try and solve it. So that was a really good discussion point. And off the back of first question that we asked about the filtering through your ideas. So that was great.
Yeah, I hate non-obvious problems. Like, that's the worst kind of problem to go after. Like, when you have to explain to your user why they have a problem, like, you know, you have an issue, right? But there's always exceptions to that rule, right? Like, one of the deals I did recently is around like gamified education. And like, I think that's a really interesting space because like the parents like don't know they have a problem, right? Like, they don't know that they have a retention problem with their kids, and it's really difficult to get them to study. But if you got them to play through games, like, you know, the kids love it, but the parents are a little bit adverse to it. So you have to sit there and explain it to them. And like, you know, that's the kind of business I would run very, very far away from, to be honest. But sometimes those kinds of businesses like generate massive cultural changes, right? For example, like the whole Uber thing, right? Like, that wasn't an obvious problem. Like, people didn't know they had a problem where they wanted to like ride share and things like that, right? Like, that's not a behavior that we were like wanting to do. And like, you know, when someone pitched to you the idea of like hopping in a random person's car, you're like, no, fuck that. I don't want to do that, right? But they like, it's still this massive cultural change, and that's a huge business. So I think there is room for it. But the average entrepreneur should not go after those difficult problems and difficult cultural changes, right? Because those are billion-dollar businesses, but very difficult to run, very difficult to start, right? If you're starting your first business, go after the most painful, obvious problem you can find, right? Someone was like, they're literally throwing money at you to solve it. Like, that's the kind of business you want to go after.
Great advice. We want to now get onto the point of the most recent company, Entry Level, has such an incredible mission, helping 1 billion people get the jobs of tomorrow through upskilling and reskilling through interactive programs and courses. Talk us through Entry Level and its incredible mission, including how you first thought of the idea.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. Like, you know, I was talking to a bunch of entrepreneurs about like their PR teams, right? And their PR teams are basically like, all right, you got to make sure that you have some incredible story. Like, you were walking around in India and you saw this guy and you were like, this is the problem, right? And it hit you like a ton of bricks. And then like, I don't have that story, unfortunately, right? Like, this has been a very slow burn. Like, I've been thinking about unemployment for like, you know, 8, 9, like even longer than that, like number of years, right? And I think it started when I started university, I was unhealthily obsessed with the idea of like being unemployed, right? For some reason, right? Like, I think it was my friends, brothers and sisters who are in engineering couldn't find jobs, or they ended up at a bank. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be unemployed as an engineer. And that's my reality. And this was like, you know, what is it like? Yeah, 9 years ago now, right? And so from there, like in first year, I spent like all my time applying for internships. I think I sent like 60 emails and I was able to get an internship, luckily, right? And then by the time it came to third, fourth year, all of my friends were like, how did you get one? Can you tell me how to get one? And that's why I started doing workshops and started a nonprofit in that space. And so I've always been thinking about like unemployment and employment. And like, the reason why I think it's really cool is because like, I think helping someone find a job, it's like one of the most meaningful things you can do to another human being, right? It's because like, a lot of people derive their value and their purpose from work, right? Mm-hmm. Not everyone, but a lot of people do, right? Because we spend 40 hours of our week, like even more sometimes, right, on that. That's a significant portion of your week spent on work. And so like, I've really enjoyed helping people one-on-one basis, like finding jobs, making introductions and things like that. Even so that like, I've done recruitment work as well, right? And so like, honestly, when it came to 2020, you know, I quit my previous job because like, it was in the hospitality space. And like, I was basically taking a sabbatical from entrepreneurship. I got burnt too many times. I was just so tired. And so I took a job, but it was in the hospitality space. And as you know, with COVID, like our revenue hit zero and we're like, okay, cool. Like, so I had to jump off that ship, come back to Australia. And I had a lot of time to think to myself in Sydney. I moved back to my parents' house because like, you know, obviously if you're not making income, no one is to be spending income. So I moved back with my parents. And I was just sort of thinking about like what to do next. And I was just like, you know what? Like, now's the time. I want to do the education space. I want to do this right. I want to tackle this space and really think about like, what is the big revolutionary change here? And so I just sat there and I started drawing my sketchbook. I was like, all right, what does education and recruitment look like? And like in my head, they should be one and the same thing, right? If realistically, university was originally built to help you get jobs, like you study and you get a job afterwards, and they're not currently doing that, what is the educational system that does help you do that? So you have things like Lambda School and all those other companies. And so it was a lot of like writing on paper and like sort of pitching ideas to people and then like getting their thoughts on it. So I was pitching people in the space and pitching people, I was pitching investors, just seeing what they thought. And honestly, the first investor pitch just like went terribly because like my first concept was like, I'm going to make like humans into stocks and like you can basically buy into them upfront and then like give them $20,000 to go study. And then once they get a job, you get a dividend paid out like from that person. And I still think that's a valid concept, right? And because it's a lot more stable than investing in startups, right? Like you can get a decent return because you're more likely to get a job than like a startup succeeding, right? And so that's how I started pitching that idea. You guys are looking at yourselves like you started, like thought about that idea as well.
That's the first time I thought about that. That's like really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's how entry level started, right? And I pitched some people and they were like, that's kind of weird. And I was like, yeah, I know. And like VCs couldn't invest in a model like that. It was very difficult. And so I was like, all right. So I just kind of kept tinkering around. And then my next idea was like, all right, I'm going to create a like an AI that tells you what job you should do. Like it takes in all your data inputs. It takes in the job market. And it's like, oh, cool. Like based on your data input, based on 10,000 people who are similar to you, we think the next job you should go into is X, right? Based on the current like number of jobs out there. Like if you spend the next 6 months reskilling to this, we think the likelihood of you getting employed would be this much, right? It was like similar to that. I was like, look, this is like one concept, but transparently, I'm just going to tackle this space and I just want to raise money to like not go find a job and just focus on this. And luckily, you know, we got some support. And so from there, it came down to throwing darts. We just kept throwing darts of like random ideas and seeing what worked. And like, we learned a lot about like what was feasible and not, right? Like we tried to build this product, that AI product from the LinkedIn database. And we realized LinkedIn is actually a very dirty data set because like it's got this whole false narrative issue. Like people put whatever they want on LinkedIn, right? It's not necessarily true. And so we couldn't build it out. And so then in February, I was thinking like, you know, we've done this workshop stuff before. Like we've done cohort-based courses for like in-person, like, you know, max maybe a couple of hundred people. I think the biggest cohorts are maybe 200 people. So like, you know, that's sort of like what I've done in the past. And I was like, you know what? Let me try and do it online. Let me try and do it online. And let's try and do it with like 5,000 people. Like that's literally what I said in February, right? And so I launched this website, like, oh, we're going to do cohort-based courses. We're going to train you how to become product manager. And we're going to train you how to become a data analyst. And we launched that with a viral loop campaign. And that went viral. Like, you know, we got about 30, 40,000 signups really, really quickly. And we're like, cool. All right. We're clearly barking up the right tree. I canned all the other experiments I was working on simultaneously. It was just like, you know, NFTs for employment, like just so many different things we're trying, right? And that's part of the experimental process. So like, even though it looks like entry level worked magically, like there were so many things that didn't work, which I just sweep under the rug. And when people ask me about it, I'll talk about it, but I don't really put that in my blogs, right? You know, but I would talk about it in podcasts because they're more long format. And so that worked out. And then we learned a lot around running courses for like these large amounts of people. So, you know, our first course was terrible, to be honest. Like, you know, we had 1,000 people, right? We only let 1,000 people in, even though we had 30,000 signups, because we just wanted to, we wanted a group of people that would be okay if you screwed up, right? Because 1,000 people out of 30 is like okay to mess up because we have another 29,000 to trial other stuff on, right? And it's a free program, so they're not really losing anything. And so the completion rates weren't great. The NPS was quite low. Like, okay. When I say quite low, it's like 55 or 60, which is like, you know, not terrible. The second time around is where we like implemented all the feedback, all the thoughts, and we ran a 6,000 person cohort. So I did exactly what I said I was going to do. I was going to run a really big cohort. NPS went sky high. Our completion rates were like 25%. So like a quarter of our cohort was finishing the programs, which was like, you know, industry average for these like MOOCs is like 3% or something, right? So like way better than everyone else. And so, yeah, we had a lot of amazing feedback from people who like, you know, were from these countries who couldn't afford these big price tags. And so that's when we knew we like figured out something really interesting around cohort-based education. No one else can run a cohort size quite like us, right? You don't have anyone else running cohort size of 6,000 people maintaining very high completion rates and like actually running it as a cohort, right? Because most of the cohort-based courses are actually just online courses that just like run at the same time, right? That's not really a cohort. Like we had a community of active participants talking to each other, working together. And then we added a paywall. So we like, we're trying to figure out how to monetize. We're like, okay, well, you know, we can't really, some of these people do, we just can't monetize. Like the price point we have to charge is like $5, right? And so we try to make the unit economics work. So we charge anywhere from $100 to $5. $5 is for people who are in economic need. So people who are from countries like Nigeria and India that have less income per year, we charge $5 for the program, which I think is also an interesting barrier because like some people genuinely have to save up for that $5 fee, which we help them like, you know, guide them throughout that process. But $5 is still affordable enough that it's kind of like for us paying a $1,000 program, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're thinking about it in the same way. We're weighing up pros and cons. We're making it like a more conscious decision to purchase that program. And then what we decided to do was like, you know what, like let's reward people for actually like studying and doing the program. So we'll do a commitment bond where we refund you the amount if you finish the program. But what we'll try and do is we'll try and upsell them at the end. So like if they finish, we'll try and tempt them with like a premium certificate and some other stuff. But if they really need the money back, they can take it. And so that's sort of the commitment bond model that we went with. And now we're at a point where we're running these monthly, like, you know, in the end, even though our completion rates are over 50% now. So you're more likely to finish if you do the program than not. Because of that financial incentive, like that doubled the completion rates. And we still end up keeping about 60% of the money that is committed in the bonds anyway. So like we have a profitable model that helps people, that people can take their money back and study for free if they want to. But for those who want to pay a little bit extra can get that value as well. So yeah, that's how it started. Not as like, you know, what, like straightforward or as linear as you may think. It was really non-linear. Like, you know, we're just sort of taking it one step at a time. You figure out the insights one step at a time. Like we first figured out how to run a cohort. Well, first of all, we figured out what idea people want, right? Even when 30,000 people signed up, I didn't actually know what they signed up for because the landing page was very vague, right? We just knew that they were interested in something around getting experience for getting a job, right? What I did was I surveyed all of those people and I said, what do you think this is? Like, what do you want? What can I give you that would be valuable? And then they told me, I built a course around that. We tested it a couple of times to make sure it was actually providing value, then added a paywall, and then like slowly built the business out that way. Now, normally I wouldn't build a business this way because I'd rather getting money up front, but we had the time and like patience to sort of figure it out. And like we're in a position where like we're not really thinking about like how to make a profitable business insanely quickly. We're more thinking about like how do we solve this problem, right? So that's why we took our time and we didn't build it in the traditional manner of like money up front, like pre-sales as quickly as possible, right? Which is how I normally would do it.
Yeah, that's really cool hearing the steps and the way that you went about it. Like, where are your most users from? Are they from the undeveloped countries that do struggle to, you know, pay for premium courses?
Yeah, Africa and India, the biggest markets.
That's so powerful.
I don't think I'll touch any other markets, to be honest. I genuinely think we could become a unicorn company just by tackling those two markets and just becoming the dominant player there. Because like, I think that it's an underserved market. Like people are frustrated with the solutions there right now. And so like, you know, we're coming in I don't even think we're the best solution, right? Like we can't compete against like a General Assembly, right? That gives you like that 1-on-30 vibe, right? Because you pay $10,000 to join a class and you have an instructor for like 1-on-1 time and stuff, right? We can't do that. But we provide a much better solution for the price point that we're providing. So I think that's the key here.
Yeah, and that kind of sets you in a whole different market in itself. Like you aren't really competing with those big courses and even like institutions and, you know, universities and everything like that, because you are in your whole different field.
Yeah. I feel like you just took us on a journey, and like, I feel like you're a really good storyteller as well. And you started off that by saying the way you came up with the idea wasn't something incredible or something like life-changing, but I think I'm probably talking for you as well. Like I really felt the problem as well. And I think it goes back to that idea around like painful problems. And it is an incredible mission as well that you guys are pushing. What are the jobs of tomorrow? Can you, I guess, define that? And then also because your target audience or target market is these underdeveloped countries, has infrastructure been a problem, I guess, with access to internet and hardware and things like that? Is that a problem at all?
I'll start with the second question. So the second question is around infrastructure. And I think that has been an insane problem. Like I was not aware of like the state of the problem. Like we're now thinking about our users. Like, you know, I think it's difficult to fully empathize with them, right? Because I'm not in their situation, right? All we can do is like ask them questions and try to figure it out. But for me to say I fully understand their situation, I think would be wrong to say, you know, because sometimes they don't have internet for some time, right? Or they don't have electricity for some time. And so, like, we get emails from customers saying, hey, I missed a deadline, but, like, I didn't have internet for the last couple of days. And we're like, oh, like, no worries, here's an extension. Like, yeah. We try to be as accommodating as possible. But they genuinely, like, put in effort and they try. And, like, we more determine that as opposed to, like, the other barriers they have. So if we can tell that they're putting in effort and they're trying, as opposed to someone giving us a story and they've never logged in once or never tried, like, you know, we can identify those sort of traits. That's been interesting. The load speed has been insane. Like, I just building a website that is robust enough for those countries, especially in the like low to middle socioeconomic classes, like has been really tough because, like, you know, some of our areas have load speeds of 97 seconds, right, on our website. And I'm like, first of all, how does Google Analytics know that? That means someone sat there for 97 seconds loading our website, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's insane. And like, I've been using Webflow and all these no-code tools to build some stuff out, but now I'm realizing there's some limitations because I physically need to build lighter websites, right? I need to get rid of stuff. And now we're like, honestly, we made a decision last week, like one of our versions of the website, which is like a light version that we quickly spun out, we're not going to have any tracking on that for a bit because like the tracking just adds so much load speed to it. So we just want to see what happens when we don't have that. And then the payment rails, even more like of a problem, right? Like I don't physically know how to get some people's money from the country to here, right? Like they don't have debit cards. They don't have physical payment rails. Like sometimes it's very difficult. So we have emails from people saying, I really want to do the program. I don't know how to pay for this. Like, is there some way for me to pay? And so like, that's been fascinating. So I think it's more so my ignorance, to be honest. Like, I just haven't tackled these issues before as an entrepreneur. So that's been really fascinating, understanding that, how to tackle it. And to be honest, most of these problems might have solutions already. I'm just not familiar with it just yet, but I've spent a lot of time trying to figure it out. I've been hanging out in forums with, like, you know, users that we have, like, in Nigeria, like, one of the top sort of, like, forums is nairaland.com. Right. If you go to it, it's a very, very old school looking website. Right. It looks like it was made in 2005. Right. But I love it because it's just so cool. And you get to see how they interact with each other and talk. And it has 40 million hits a month. Right.
Wow.
So we're talking like a huge website in Nigeria. And so, like, yeah, it's been fascinating getting to know the users, seeing what the trials and tribulations are like. You know, how much money do they earn a year? And like, how do we fit in their lifestyle? You know, electricity issues, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. That's your second question. It's been a really fascinating journey the last couple of months learning about that. The first question was about jobs of tomorrow, right? So jobs of tomorrow, I think there's some really fascinating like trends that are happening, right? Like, first of all, we're going to have 1 billion new internet users by 2030, which is going to be like really interesting, right? Like, what are those people going to be doing like on the internet, right? Like, how do they use the internet? And I think like fundamentally, I was looking at some of the operating systems that are being used in like India and like, you know, the other countries. And like, one, they're a lot more like slim, like, you know, they're a lot like less bandwidth heavy and things like that. The devices are very different. The way they use their apps is very different. Like, and so that's been interesting. It seems like everything is moving towards tech, right? Like all the jobs are in tech right now. Like when you look at the job market, it's not that there's not enough jobs sometimes. It's actually just like a skill gap issue where you have a lot of jobs in one area and then you have less jobs in the other area, but people haven't migrated to that skill set just yet. And so like one of the issues right now is that we're not lacking entry-level software engineers, UX designers, et cetera. We're lacking mid to senior people, right? We just don't have enough experienced people to fill in some of these gaps. Like we try to hire a software engineer, and we couldn't find anyone like that was like the right skill level that, you know, we thought was good. And like in the end, we just put the hiring on hold until some of this stuff calms down. But we're seeing the great resignation, which is huge. Like everyone's quitting their jobs. Everyone's moving to different places because now they realize that like, one, money isn't the highest priority anymore because everyone is paying a lot of money in these tech jobs. And so like, it's no longer, all right, they're paying me 200 here and 150 here. It's like, oh, they pay me 140, but like, the culture is way better and like the mission is more aligned with what I'm doing. So I think that's been fascinating. But it seems like for the jobs of tomorrow, like your biggest defensibility, right? There's a couple of defensibilities, three main points. One is globalization, right? And like that's an interesting attack vector because like, to be honest, there's probably someone with the exact same name as me in India that's probably like, you know, 1/5 of the cost of what I cost, and probably like even smarter than me. Like another Ajay Prakash, who's like a data scientist, who's just way smarter than me, right? And so like, why would someone hire me over that person? Well, I think your defensibility against globalization and like the talent market that's going overseas and remote is the soft skills that come with it. Like, you know, the presentation skills, the rapport that you build with people, the relationships, right? Mm. So I think soft skills have become more and more important as opposed to like in the current job market. And I think an underrated skill set as well. And like the strategic elements, like the enterprising skills, like how you think about problem solving, things like that, is something that you can defend against when it comes to these hard skills. The second one is like automation, right? Like if automation is going to automate away the jobs, like we have to make sure that we're on the right side of automation, right? Mm-hmm. That we understand how to use these tools and like have a bit more digital literacy. And so I think the jobs that are going to become more common are like a lot more techy. And I'm not saying they all become software engineers, but like you have to be able to use and wield tech in a meaningful way. Like being able to use no code tools, being able to view and use data in a meaningful way, like all those sort of things. And then like the last sort of vector that I think is going to be interesting for like the job market is like flexibility. So like flexibility in a lot of different ways. Like one, work culture, like the way you work will be flexible. You may be working 3 jobs instead of 1 job, right? Where you like have, you know, work 2 days at one company, 3 days at another company. More people are going to become freelancers. Like a third of Australia's workforce is like, you know, in flexible working conditions, right? And so I think flexibility is a really interesting factor where companies have to become more flexible and people have to become more flexible in the way they work. So, you know, if I was to sum it up, basically, if you want to make sure you're defensible and like, you know, are working in the jobs tomorrow, it's going to be a lot more interpersonal skill sets and like, you know, relationship building. You're going to have a lot more digital literacy. So being able to build data, being able to build technology. And a third vector for me is like being open to more flexible working conditions. Like the gig economy is going to become even bigger. Like, companies will have to become a lot more flexible in the way they let people work, right? So I think there's going to be a lot more interesting factors in that regard.
So interesting. It's like things that we, I guess, never really thought of, or it's kind of out of our scope.
We had a discussion a little while ago. It was on the coast about Naval and him talking about the future. Remember the point that you said?
Yeah.
And it's like you hit the nail on the head with all those points. I can't remember what.
Yeah. So I think it was, I was listening to one of Naval's podcasts and he was talking about, I guess, the future and the way that it'll look. And as you said, like automation and AI and things like this, potentially, or even with globalization, a lot of these like hard skills will be automated away. And the most valuable will be, I guess, these decision-making and more strategic sort of like roles, as well as kind of like a freelancing economy where you're kind of working for specific projects for 3 months and then traveling for the rest. And it's really interesting seeing like how it's all going to shape out and just so different. And how quickly have things changed from like that classic 9-to-5 or like factory job even, like which was like 50 years ago. Yeah, things are just moving so quickly.
Yeah, for sure. And like you can see that like I think COVID has like accelerated a lot of time frames where people have just made really interesting decisions. And that's like why the great resignation is happening. People are just realizing other things are more important and like they're prioritizing different things. Like even now, like a big part of my role is to keep my team. Like, so I have to now do things like monthly games nights and like things like that because we're remote at the moment, unfortunately. And so I've got to think of other ways to keep the team engaged. You know, I have to introduce like an L&D budget, like things like that to make sure that we have other tangible things. But I think even more so, the most interesting thing with company retention is like most people quit their bosses, not their jobs, right? Mm-hmm. And so like we have to be really cognizant of like giving positive feedback and appreciation like amongst the company. And so that's like a big vector around like keeping talent as well. Like I think people would take less pay if you just appreciated them more, right? Like that's a really important factor. And I realize that more and more like over the last few years as I've been hiring and working with other people.
We kind of noticed there's two types of strategies that companies tend to go towards in the early stages of marketing. The ones that are hesitant to spend on money on marketing or may not actually have a budget, and those that just throw endless amounts of money at it. How important is marketing firstly? And how can someone who has an idea, potentially even a product, market themselves in the early stages without an already existing audience?
Yeah, that's a That's a really interesting one. I think with the internet, like, it's become so easy to like market yourselves, right? Like, you don't really need to like build an audience up front. Like, I think it's become so accessible, right? Like, the fact that you can just put money into a Facebook ad thing, like, you know, the Facebook ad manager, and just be like, all right, here's $100. Go find me people who are interested in my product. Like, that's insane, right? Like, that wasn't a thing back in the day. And so, like, honestly, like, it's product market fit. And I think if you have product market fit in an organic sense, like, when I launch something, I try not to put any money into marketing, because if the product is good enough, it should fly off the shelves. And like, I don't say that in a way of like, build the product and they will come. That's not how it works. I mean that in a way, like, try to get as much organic traffic as possible. So when I started entry level, I was posting in Facebook groups nonstop all the time, just random Facebook groups. I was like posting in LinkedIn groups. I was posting in Slack groups, just wherever I could, right? Various ideas, different iterations. I remember even like I did an accelerator pitch, speed pitching, where you have to like speed pitch a bunch of mentors and they vote on whether you get in or not. And like, what I did was I took that opportunity to like A/B test my pitch. And so like, I pitched one idea to one investor and I pitched another idea to another investor. And like, it ended up being really bad for me at the end, because like, they were just very confused. But I got a lot of good data out of that, because I didn't really care. Like, I was just more doing it for the data as opposed to anything else. So, you want to get it out there as quickly as possible. And like, there are so many different means to get your word out there. You don't need to rely on money, and you don't need to rely on an existing audience. But like, I'll give you a framework, right? So just so people can walk away with something tangible. When I launch something, I think of three things that can help me launch this as quickly as possible. Like, one is product. The second thing is distribution. And the third thing is brand, right? I think if you have all three of these things, you can launch anything effectively, right? So like, you know, when I think about launching, and sometimes it's difficult for you to get all of these things like ready to go. But if you have a really good product concept, and then you find like, you know, maybe you find a company that has 50,000 subscribers in this thing, but you know that their audience would love this product, right? And you can give them a revenue share, and they don't have this product, and you only have this product, right? You have some informational arbitrage they don't have. And so you go to them and say, like, I have this amazing product. I'll give you revenue share if you sell it to your audience. Like, that's how good the product is. And like, you got to make sure you have a really good product, right? You got to bring one of these three parts of the triangle in a very meaningful way. Then you may go to another company and say, like, hey, will you like, you know, endorse this product for me? Like, you know, I want like the Nike brand on this product, but like, you know, I want you to add your name to it. If you have that, like, you have a distribution channel, within that distribution channel, people respect that brand and you have a good product, your launch will go effectively. There's no way that your launch fails, right? If you have those three things. And so you don't need to think that high up every single time. Like, you just find someone that has distribution, maybe 1,000 people, maybe you find like a university society, right? And then you find a brand, like maybe you find like a well-respected person, right? Like maybe the president of like X stock, like, you know, is willing to like help out and be like a spokesperson for it, like, you know, make a quick video. You don't need to think so ambitiously, right? You don't need to go like to top branding person. You don't need to go to the top distribution person, but making sure you have those three things is really important. And you maybe don't even have the product. Like, maybe you guys decide to do the distribution angle, right? You start drop shipping products to your audience, right? Like, you don't need a product. You can just figure out the product side. So I would focus on one of those three things in that launch triangle, focus on that, and then like work with other people to make the other two happen.
Yeah, that's powerful.
We read that in a blog post of yours as well about the marketing strategy and the analytics of entry level. And it was interesting because one of our earlier episodes, we had this guest on, and it was about, I don't know if you've heard of Wim Hof and the methods surrounding that.
Yeah.
We got an author that lived alongside Wim Hof himself, and we got him on the podcast, and we did the challenge ourselves, and we said, oh, like, a good way to market it is we'll go to all the Facebook groups and jump into the Wim Hof, like, Facebook groups in Australia and everything like that, and have a couple videos of us jumping in the ice bath, and then at the end of that, market to our episode. And it was, we got absolutely roasted, like, all these old, like, men, and everyone was just roasting us, saying, oh, this isn't a business page, like, should be selling this and that. And like, it was an interesting point because in your blog, you said like the tactic that you did around it was a lot smarter than ours. And you kind of gave them really good, valuable insights into something that they can like draw their attention to. And it was that little, the photo of the chicken and the egg.
Yeah.
And it was like a university degree and no experience or something.
And I wrote like a really long blog post.
Yeah.
No, but that's awesome. Like you learned something from that, right? Like I think you need to do those things. Like I remember like I got banned off Ozbargain because I tried to like sort of like promote something. And I forgot what it was, but like I didn't have any terms and conditions on the website. So they like banned me. They're like, oh, you don't have any terms and conditions. And people were like roasting me in Ozbargain. Like it was for like a beer company. Like I was trying to launch a beer thing, but like we're doing customized brews. So you drag and drop your ingredients and then we like make it for you and send it to your house, right? But the issue is it's very expensive to make beers like that. And so like we were selling six packs for like $60 and we put on Ozbargain. And that's not a bargain, right? That's like the opposite of a bargain. And so it got flamed so hard. Like I remember like just like every morning I wake up and read these like really like rude comments the entire time. And then we just got banned off it. And I was like, thank God we got banned. I did not want to see that anymore.
Another thing we did when we first launched the podcast was we kind of took that approach of messaging groups. But I was reading the terms and conditions of this really big group. It was like 15,000 people. It was like called Men's Finance Advice or something. And one of the conditions is like no advertisement. So then I just found one of the people who created the group and like messaged him individually. And he was like a financial advisor. And I was like, talked to him about the podcast and things like that. And like got his permission.
Did you even have a call with him?
Oh yeah. I actually called it. Yeah. I had a call with him like that night and we're like talking through it. And I was like, kind of more like, oh, like how'd you get to where you are? Like, you know, like sort of that thing. And then we end up being able to post into the page fine. So that's like another thing we tried.
But it was like a good reminder for us to, we did that early on, but we haven't been doing that lately. And it was like a really good reminder of reading your blog post that we should really knuckle down on that stuff and constantly do it. Like not just do it once and say, all right, our job's done. Like constantly do it and try different things.
Well, I think you'll have diminishing returns, right? Like after a point, like you have to move to another acquisition strategy. But like, I think that's pretty interesting that you guys did that. But like, I think I should have added that. Like when I saw groups that said like no advertising allowed, I would DM the like the owner and be like, hey, this is what I'm sort of doing. It's for free. Like any leeway here? Like, what do you think? Like, and then, you know, I'd say 50% of the time they'd be like, oh yeah, that's cool. Like if it's free, if you can show us that you're not making any money out of it, like, and you're going to run the program for free, then like totally fine. Or they want to hop on a call and like chat about it real quick before we post it. Or they just said, nah, man, like we're not letting you do that. And then no harm, no foul. No right?
That's
awesome that you did that. Yeah.
We're going to ask another question, but we're very conscious of time. We'll finish with, I think one last one. What are three things you wish you knew when you first started on your entrepreneurial journey? This one's a tough one. It always is.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think that like the usual question, I guess, like what would you tell your younger self? And I would just tell them to chill out, like just relax. Because I think I was just like so impatient with everything. And I think if I realized that like, you know, things would take time and like if I reflect back, then I'm really appreciative of like the learnings and the journey that I've gone through, right? Even though sometimes I look back and be like, oh, I didn't make as much money as I thought I would. Like, you know, I'm not at a position. Like, even when I got on the Forbes list, I didn't feel like I earned it because I felt like an imposter. I felt like, oh, everyone here is a millionaire. Like, I'm not even a millionaire yet. Like, I'm still like on that journey. And so like, you know, because there's been often times that I get all my money and I'll put it into a business and then it goes to zero, right? Mm. And so like, there's definitely times when my cash flow was like net zero every month, right? I just like have no money. So I think the three things I'd wish I told myself is one, like prioritize health is like the big thing. I think like there's a big issue with like people not sleeping and like eating incorrectly and like, you know, they don't take care of themselves, right? And I think it's important to work as much as possible, which I don't agree with, right? I think having a balanced lifestyle is super important. So I think that's the first thing I would just say, like, you know, relax, chill out, take care of yourself and like make sure you take care of like not just yourself, but your relationships and things like that, right? Like I think those things don't need to suffer because you're hustling on a startup. Like I don't think that's a valid excuse. Like, I don't believe in that whole mantra, like, you know, work in your 20s and like, you know, work in your 30s and then relax when you're 40, right? Like, I don't believe in that. I think like when you're 20, you should be enjoying life, right? And so like, that's the first thing. Second thing is probably like, I think I would have taken more measured bets. Like one of the issues I had was the fact that like, I put all my money into like startups, right? I put like every dollar I made, I reinvested and try something, right? And so there was many years where I just like had no money, right? Like, just didn't have any like spare cash, right? And so I wish like I had a more measured approach in terms of investing in stocks and investing in like property and like, you know, just sort of like hedging my bets a little bit more, right? Because in my head, for some reason, it was like, I'm either going to win or lose. Like I'm either on the streets or I'm going to like be super successful and there's no in between. And I wish that like, you know, I maybe took a little bit more of a measured approach. And you know, now I have more of a stock portfolio and like I've built out a bit more of like a safety net. But I wish I did that a lot earlier because I think I'd be in a better position today. So relax and then, you know, invest basically. And then I think the other thing I wish I knew is like, I wish I learned how to code earlier. Like, I think that would have been a lot more helpful. Like if I knew how to build things earlier, because if you know how to build things, like you want to do your best to be a solopreneur. Like I think building out the skill sets yourself is like super valuable, right? Mm. So now it's like the tech side is not as important because there's so many no code tools out there, right? So if you become a no code developer, I think you can kind of get away with like just being really good at marketing, being a no code developer and being good at sales. Like you can kind of do the entire thing. But back then I wish I'd probably put in more time to learning code earlier, right? Like I learned how to code when I was like maybe 5-6 years ago, right? As opposed to like 10 years ago. So I wish I started earlier. Yeah.
That's awesome. They're like great pieces of advice. I think a lot of people can bring that on board. That's something that I've been thinking about. Yeah. I remember we've talked about this a little bit, like the importance of coding, because that's something that we found a lot of people we've interviewed have said the exact same thing, like how important it is, especially if these people are trying to build businesses, build new ideas and things like that. And they've all said a similar thing.
And marketing as well.
Yeah.
Like we had a chat about this the other day. In terms of our skill set, and like we kind of came to the conclusion that we need to be building those skills in house and yeah. really be like nailing down on those like marketing and edits and stuff like that. So
yeah, no, it's so true.
I think you always realize that you're like continuing learning as well. Like what was interesting was like this week I had a call with an entrepreneur who is just like so much better at marketing than I am, and like I teach that growth marketing course, and like I was listening to this guy and I'm like, oh my God, like I feel like a novice. Like I literally just did a growth marketing lesson like right before this. And now I'm learning from this guy and realize like, I don't know anything. And like, it's just like, you know, when you're level 40 and you meet like a level 99 with a skill cape in RuneScape, you're like, holy shit, this guy's like insane. And so like, yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think you have to have that learning mindset. Like, because I think I know people for sure definitely would have approached that meeting with like, no, I already know what I'm talking about. Like I teach a growth marketing course. I already know what I'm talking about. But I try to be as honest as possible. Like I teach the course, but at the same time, I still tell my students like, look, I'm still learning a lot of things too. And there are definitely people that know more than me. And when I do know, when I see that, I'm going to write as many notes as possible and hopefully give that back to you guys. Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you got to constantly be like upping your skill set and like learning new things. And like the tech space is just changing every day. I feel like, you know, I took a break from like Facebook marketing for a bit, and then I came back and everything's different. I was like, what the hell is a, you know, CBO? And like, what are all these like new terms and things like that? I completely forgot everything. So you got to relearn everything.
Yeah. Something we always talk about on the podcast, Forever Learn. And I guess keep going on that. Well, thank you so much for taking up so much of your time. And we really appreciate you sticking past the hour we blocked out. But yeah, thank you so much again for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And we know our audience and even we gain so much from this discussion. It gets us so pumped. But we want to give you the opportunity to, I guess, hand over to you and provide our audience with where they can find a little bit more about you and everything you've got going on.
Yeah, I want to figure out my media strategy too at some point. I have no idea what I'm doing there. But if you want to read about me, you can just type my full name, ajprakash.net. And then you can check out entry level as well if you want. It's primarily for like Africa and India, but there are definitely a lot of Australian students that come through and American students that come through. And I do think it's valuable for you guys, but like we build, like I don't say this in a bad way. I still love you Australians and Americans, but you're an unintended consequence of our product, right? Like you come through, like we have love for you, but like we're focused on different markets, but I'll make sure you're taken care of if you come to entry level.
That's awesome. And we would love to have another episode in the future sometime, like to hear about what's been happening in the year, what you guys have done, and we'd love to hear all the amazing things.
Yeah, 100%. This was fun. Happy to help.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you want to stay up to date with what's new, remember to press follow on your chosen podcast platform.
You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at Young Opportunist. Once again, thanks for listening.
Catch you next time.